Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a combat engineer in World War II shares some of his closest calls and pays tribute to one of the more than 400,000 Americans who never came home from the war.
He had undoubtedly put his body on that mine to keep it in the ground where the pellets would not go far.
Hear all the emotional memories of this incredibly sharp 92-year-old. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show that reminds you no matter... Oh, he's laughing already. None of these guys want to be called heroes, but for the rest of us who weren't alive during World War II, their willingness to put their lives on the line for our country is certainly admirable. And the idea is, no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small it might be, there are men and women around you who have done things you might not even imagine for the sake of our freedom. Today's show comes to you from Arroyo Grande, California, on the Central Coast, where folks have been listening to Hometown Heroes on 920 KVEC. Our guest today was a combat engineer in World War II, 92-year-old Vern Jackson. Not originally from California's coast, a much different climate. In Madison, South Dakota, what's the coldest temperature you ever remember experiencing as a young boy?
38 degrees below zero. At that point, you bring in the mercury thermometers, they'll freeze. My dad was night watchman on the campus, and I follow him around the route at night lots of times, and I saw the thermometer say 38. I don't know why they did or not. I can lie a little, can't I?
Most of us, thankfully, have never experienced that. What does it feel like when it's 38 below?
When we got into the National Guard, we were very happy to get those heavy wool overcoats, wool pants, and wool shirts because we had lots of cold weather. Not that cold, but once or twice. But what does it feel like? What? That temperature? Oh, heck, I don't know. I've forgotten. It was cold.
Your memory of that froze, I suppose. Well, and we're going to get to some of your experiences in the war, some experiences not too many people can talk about in North Africa and in Italy as a combat engineer. But let's talk about how that started. You mentioned signing up for the National Guard, and you did this at a pretty young age. What was the idea behind that? How did that all come about?
The National Guard had summer camps. And the local company, Company A, Madison, was desirous of being full strength for the summer camp. The captain came to the campus, or to the high school, wanted people, guys, to sign up. Well, he said, if you aren't quite 18, just say you are, there'll be no problem. Some buddies of mine that knew I needed to be come a little more worldwise, I guess, talked me into signing up. And so I lied away a year of my life to get in the National Guard. A couple weeks later, we were on our way to Rapid City, South Dakota, where Camp Rapid was, and spent 2 weeks there. And that was my introduction into military service. It was sort of military, National Guard.
To put it in perspective for folks, this is long before America entered World War II. You're talking about 1938?
39. I had turned 18 about 2 weeks after I told him I was already 18.
So it wasn't that big of a lie, only a couple weeks.
That's right. I'm not a big liar, just a small liar.
That's what we all say, right? So you're in the National Guard, and things are changing all around you. When did you realize that this might be more of a long-term thing for you, not just something to go and camp and get a cool wool parka?
The beginning, there was no worry of war, I don't think. The second camp a year later was in Camp Ripley, Minnesota, north of Minneapolis a ways. We may have had some sense of it. It was beginning, we're beginning to think about it. But that fall, it became much more real. It wasn't too long, and they talked about mobilizing us for a year of federal training, National Guard. Somebody was thinking, well, Franklin D. was thinking ahead, I think. Yeah. I say again and again, your sons will never fight on foreign soil. Yeah, well, they were already building bases over in Ireland, and I found that out.
So this is still, again, before Pearl Harbor, but you end up in what you expect to be a year in the military, and it's during this time that the attack on Pearl Harbor happens. Where were you on December 7th?
I was in the company street in front of the supply tent where I had been developing, printing pictures, developing film, printing pictures that night, I don't know who brought the news to me, but they did. Pearl Harbor has been bombed, and that was a bit of a shock, Then we knew this is war. We knew it immediately, and it was just no time at all, and we were making preparations to move out. We'd had 11 months of our year. There was nothing to stop us. We didn't know where we were going to be going, but we, within 2 weeks, we were aboard a train. I had the detail that guarded the equipment train. The rest of the battalion, I guess we were a regiment at the time. We later became a triangular division, and we had then three companies instead of six. They had left earlier by train and were going east. None of us knew where we were going, but we were going east and into cold weather. Because Louisiana hadn't been anything. It was very nice down there. I liked Louisiana.
And that's where you were on December 7th, was Camp Claiborne?
Yes. As I said, in the company street outside the supply tent. I can't forget that.
So I guess I should ask you also, you're in this National Guard, and you're activated for a year of federal service with war drums banging, and now there is a war. How did it happen that you became a combat engineer? Is that something you volunteered for? Is that something the Army said, you know what, he'd be good at this? How did that happen?
34th Red Bull Infantry Division has, at the time, I think it was six companies of engineers, combat engineers, which were assigned to support the infantry.
Well, I was just wondering if there was a moment where the Army figured out, oh, this is something that he's good at, or is that something you wanted to do?
That didn't develop until after the war. We were combat engineers, which doesn't really mean engineer. Well, it does, because you build bridges and roads and put together Bailey bridges. You do all the dirty work, the shovels and picks.
Take apart mines, find mines, see your friends blown up by mines. Pretty dangerous duty. I don't want you to understate it here.
Well, the dangerous part, we had to learn about them when we were in Ireland for 6-8 months. We got some general idea that the British tried to give us of German equipment, but it wasn't until we got to Africa and found mines and took them apart and played with them and put them back together, maybe. Well, mines are a special thing. They have a hole in them in which screws a detonator, and then there's maybe a trip wire, or maybe it's, if they're tank mines, the top of them squashes and detonates them. Well, we had to learn all these things. We had to learn about S mines, the one that jumps out of the ground about, well, randomly originally. Eventually they put a wire on them so they would go up about 6 feet and blow up. But originally they'd go up random. We lost a couple of guys just trying to learn what goes into a S mine. What they do.
And that begs the question, what did that do to you? I mean, what's your mindset when you see stuff like that? You see your friends getting blown up or guys that you know. Doesn't it occur to you that you're doing something pretty dangerous, that you might not be around tomorrow?
Yeah. One of the things we got to do was run mine schools for the infantry. We didn't piddle around. We used live explosives, and we lost several guys. I was supposed to be one of them, but I've lucked out.
Well, I think everyone hears you say that and says, okay, there's a story there, so tell us that story.
Oh, my. It kind of spoils the threat. Three of us had transferred from the line company into headquarters company. This is just over the last 8 months of the war, before the end of the war. One, Joe Pauly, was a camouflage expert. Fred Buckmeyer was a demolitions expert, and he was too. He designed some things. And I was the chemical warfare type. That's not what we did in headquarters company, however, we ran mine schools. Fortunately, this particular time when there was an explosion that killed a couple of guys and I think neutralized Fred, because he was right by the truck, but protected by the body of the back of the dump truck, so that he didn't get too many shrapnel pieces in him, but he got some. We had a pass to Rome. We were in a rest area for this training, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So instead of being with the outfit, we were off to Rome. However, that did happen on Monday, first day of the school. We could have been there, but we just weren't. That was a kind of a minor thing. It was just the supplies in the back of the truck that we were running the school with. But we had a roll of Primacord, detonators, and some TNT in the back there. It all blew up kind of hard on two guys. One fellow, there was an infantryman, 100th Battalion man, sitting on an open-air John, 50 yards away or so, and a piece of shrapnel got him, killed him, as well as a couple of our guys. But Joe and I lucked out. We were not going to be, we were excused for the whole week, happily.
So I know this isn't the nowhere near the only close call that you had during the service. But basically, you and your friend were excused for the week, and one of your buddies and some other people, a couple of them killed and others wounded because of something that could have happened at any point. Just all this explosive material went up?
Have no idea what might have done it. No idea. I wouldn't even guess now, but there was something, and there were items there, that concussion or slight, not just jolting, but you'd pinch them. It would be the main thing. If it was, whether it was one cap or something under a box, and the box got shifted, it would start what could be a building up of from the little fire to an enormous one. I don't mean to say fire, explosion, that's what I really mean.
I know we're going to hear about some of the more than 300 days you spent in combat, but even some of the days where you weren't in combat, you're around explosive material all the time. How did you approach that? Because I think a lot of guys would have been scared out of their minds. You don't seem to be too bent out of shape about it. How did you deal with that ever-present?
We took it apart to learn about it. I guess we had some idea of dying when we went overseas, and so it was always a background item, but you didn't think about it until the time you get shot at. Now, then you would begin to say, is this the time?
Did you think you were going to come home from the war?
Yes, I hope so.
Why? What gave you that assurance?
At the time, I had no faith, Christian faith. I wasn't depending on the Lord for protection. I feel fully that he was watching me from day one, though, from birth on up, because I've lived a long time and I've had a lot of experiences where I could have got killed. But I had a good friend there in the service, this man, Walter Burkett, who is a strong, very strong Christian, and he tried to convert me, shall we say. I'd probably better edit this out, but I'll say it for now. I said, by golly, if I could live through this and get home, I'm going to rewrite that Bible. I'm going to take out the blood and the lamb and the silly stuff, which is so terrible to think of, even almost. But somebody else beat me to it. I better not name him.
Well, I think that's interesting to hear you put it that way, that you have a faith now, an understanding of what was happening then that you couldn't grasp at the time. And let's fill in some of those details there about some of the intense experiences you had. I've interviewed quite a few guys that were in North Africa, but they're getting harder and harder to find. So many of the veterans that are still around were maybe in Europe or maybe in the Pacific, but North Africa happened so early and didn't last as long as those other areas. Do you ever find people, when you tell them that you served in North Africa, that they weren't even aware that the U.S. was in North Africa during the war? Have you ever gotten some surprised reactions?
There's a lot of young people that have no concept of anything back that far. But I'm surprised at how many students of World War II there are around. I mean, young people, I've got a good friend in the church that he's bent on learning about that time. It's interesting to him. And there's quite a few people in that category.
Well, and I want to hit on the things that you think are important for those of us who weren't there to understand about it. What was it like for a boy from South Dakota to land in North Africa and then find himself witnessing some pretty intense battles between American forces and Rommel and the Germans?
Well, fortunately, I was, as a combat engineer, not front line. We bivouacked back somewhere, spent our days. At night, we'd go forward, lay barbed wire, lift mines, lay mines, build roads. If we could do it in the daytime, we would, but much of it was done at night.
And you talk about building roads, and I imagine most of us don't know how you would go about building a road in the desert that tanks and convoys are going to have to use.
Maybe you clear a hole through a cactus patch by chopping down cactus. Then you have what we called wadis, creeks. And there'd be water in the bottom of them, and they'd probably 200 feet across and 8 foot deep. And then in the bottom of it was the creek, was the wadi. So you get your bulldozer in there, and you get knocked down the wall, so you get down to that water level, and I don't remember what we did, so you get actually through the water, depending on size of it, of course. But we had culverts available, we had Bailey bridges, that's for big things. Bailey bridges are all over the place, incidentally. I've found them here in the, well, San Luis Obispo. When it first came, there was a bridge street. And on Bridge Street was an outfit that manufactured Bailey Bridge segments. They were, 12 feet long, 4 foot high, went together like tinker toys, you might say. And they had big piles of them. Very recently, they had a road failure, and they got some Bailey Bridge parts and built a, this is all within the last 4 years. That's up by the Cal Poly. That was there for a year or so while they redid the road under it. I found them in Canada. I found them in various places in the United States. And among the places where I found them, we were in Israel. From Jordan over to Israel, a Bailey Bridge.
Well, if folks have seen the movie A Bridge Too Far, they know what you're talking about. There were thousands of those modular prefabricated bridges built by engineers in World War II. And all the engineers I've talked to have said it was a pretty simple process.
You build it, a section of it on the ground. You push it out until it teeters. And then you build another. Eventually, it'll teter down on the other side. So it's a better somebody over there better be building an abutment for you.
So building bridges was part of what you did as a combat engineer, but there was quite a bit more, and we're going to discuss that when we come back. 92-year-old Vernon Jackson of Arroyo Grande is our guest. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.
Help us help a veteran. The Farney Automotive Group in Selma is supporting the Central Valley Honor Flight. A portion of the profit from every new and used vehicle sale in the month of August will be donated to help send our local veterans on an unforgettable trip to Washington, D.C. The Central Valley chapter is chartering flights in honor of their sacrifice and service to our country. Join the Farney Automotive Group in Selma and support our veterans for one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting this week with 92-year-old Vern Jackson of Arroyo Grande on California's Central Coast, a long way from where he grew up in Madison, South Dakota, an even further journey from where he served with the 109th Combat Engineers, part of the famous Red Bull Division, the 34th Infantry Division in World War II. We got into North Africa a little bit, but we did not discuss the trip over there. And I guess that was memorable too, but not necessarily in a good way.
The first threat to life and limb was when we got aboard ship in New York Harbor and headed east, not knowing where we were going, but got aboard ship and we were part of a big armada. However, second day out, we were on the North Atlantic in February, the world's roughest ocean, the roughest time of the year, in a little World War I transport, which hauled mules in World War I. It was a very tiny ship, and our company, I think, filled the ship. I'm not sure. There wasn't another company there. There may have been some infantry or some other units, but that ship was tiny, and we did 45-degree rolls. Now, 45-degree, we were told that. I didn't measure them. We were told by the people who ran the ship, and the ship could have tipped over. Could have capsized and we would all been gone. That was first threat to life and limb. The second would be in combat.
And that combat came in what was the first large-scale confrontation between American and German forces in all of World War II, the Battle of the Kasserine Pass, a two-mile gap in the Atlas Mountains where the Americans foiled Field Marshal Erwin Rommel and his Nazi forces. This all happened in February of 1943, and you were there. So what do you remember about that?
Oh, goodness gracious. I don't think I can be real brief and tell you. We had been on a flank working eastward in Tunisia. We had a couple of weeks to build a road for 10 miles or so, 15, maybe 20, 30. I don't have any real feel for it. They came around that morning and they says, by night, we retreat over this, whatever you build tonight. I happen to have been on guard duty the night before, and so we were in the, well, I don't remember how I heard the words. I don't know. Of the retreat, but that's what it was. In fact, there had been two Arabs with us that morning early, Claire and I had been on guard. Guy came in and volunteered to start a fire and heat some water for us. We were doing it, and he just took over and helped. Did our laundry, as a matter of fact. I wonder if he wasn't a spy checking things out. I suspect he was. As a matter of fact, such things as that cause some of our fellows to feel pretty free if they see a gentleman over on a hillside sitting there with his sheep, maybe. Target practice. Actually, it happened. There were some killed by guys that just felt that way about loners that were hanging around. Later, a guy came in with his camel. Again, I wonder. Morning after the retreat, we were sitting in our truck back, and there was a captain, an officer. He was trying to question an Arab, and the Arab would get him by the shoulders and plead. And he says, "Get away." Pushed him away three times. And finally, he got kind of tired of it, and he pulled out his .45 and shot the guy. Spun him around on the ground. Shot him in the back of the head, and he went flat on the ground. That was all within. That was my first experience with that sort of actually seeing somebody killed at close range.
That kind of makes it hit home for you that you're living in a little different world now, huh?
Different? Much worse. Not locally, but what's going on over in Egypt right now is horrifying and terrifying, heartbreaking.
It sounds like you can empathize a little bit, or you can imagine what it's like because of some of the things you experienced.
Civilians were, if they were the enemy populace, they could be killed. We didn't worry about the fact that there might be a civilian standing by a soldier. They got wiped out if it was appropriate.
Well, and later you would witness, I think, one of the most famous examples of that kind of balance between military targets and civilian importance when you got to Cassino, Italy. But what else about your time in North Africa really sticks with you? What are some of those images that you still see every now and again when you reflect?
Fortunately, we were a different generation. I'm not saying we were the great generation, because you know my story. The great generation is the one that raised the soldier generation through the Dust Bowl and Depression years.
You feel more fondly about your parents and their generation than your own.
I feel that they are the ones that turned out a group of men who loved their country, were capable of going to war and dying for their country. Doesn't take anything away from the soldier, but it recognizes that people like, especially my parents, were very, very effective, hard-working, no relief, and yet they were poor. No government help. They were very poor, but they were so ingenious in so many ways that we lived through the Depression and the Dust Bowl days without suffering, really. We more learned wisdom, I think, of true wisdom through it rather than suffering from it. Combat engineers have a different position in combat. You don't, you're handling dangerous things, and people get killed handling. Lifting minefields is dangerous. The time Kasserine that you talk about, the minefield that stopped Rommel, was just below us immediately. We had been turned into infantry, issued ammunition and hand grenades and such, positioned on a hill above the valley. We couldn't actually see the valley from where we were because it was more mountain. But those mines stopped the Germans. Well, the Germans got that far, and we heard them come up the valley all the way. The combat was coming up, and it got up just below us to that minefield, I think, and it stopped there. Well, a couple of days later, we were lifting those mines, and we loaded trucks with the mines. Hopefully, we took the detonators out of them. Of course, we did. Spider mines, they call them. They've got a kind of a weird framework over the top of them, which catches the tank threads and presses on the detonator, which is in the center of the mine. We sent a truckload of those back up to the area where we had just retreated from. And one of our squads was unloading the truck and laying out a minefield. Something caused that truckload of mines to blow up. 12 men, one of them, the sergeant, was the furthest away. He was plotting out the minefields, and he was killed, but so was the entire squad. I was on the other end picking the mines up and loading the trucks. I have terrible feelings about it because, gosh, could we have missed something? That is my first real horror in the war, perhaps.
But certainly not the last. What are some of those other moments that have stuck with you all these years?
The bombing of a town, dive bombers, German Stukas. And they were not too far away, maybe 10 miles, but they were full, easy to see. Maybe it was less than that, too, I don't know. They came out over the top of us. We shot at them, And we had kind of sport almost, because we could see the tracer bullets curve seemingly up into them. Well, it drew their attention, and the 88 millimeters were positioned across quite a ways over on a high piece of ground, and they started shooting at us. And I had a nice deep foxhole, sort of a standing foxhole, so I was down. But the shells came in pretty thick and furious. One of them, fortunately, was a dud, lit just off the elbow of one of our guys. Only one guy was killed. One guy was killed by that. We shouldn't have shot at him.
But I'm sure that's a lesson that you learned at that point, huh?
No. Another time I wanted to shoot at him, but we didn't have time. Kasserine, the minefield, one of the aircraft, and it was probably a Messerschmitt, came off the bombing run and was so low over us that we could see the pilot's face. I swear I saw him turn his head and look at us. But it was so quick, we didn't have time to get our guns out. And that meant darn quick. Now, that was not scary, but it was kind of close encounter.
I guess so. I know there's another time, too. You saw three airplanes coming at you, and we're planning to shoot them down, too, until you realize that would be a bad idea.
This is back in Africa. Yeah, my squad was building a road through the cactus patch. And we had not seen any American fighters. We'd seen a few C-47s going high, and that's all we'd seen. While we're working in the cactus patch, here come three airplanes right straight at us, and quite low. And unhappily, my first gunner was headed for the cactus. We had gotten a transfer in from the regular army, who had some guts. And he and I were heading for the 50 caliber machine gun mounted on that truck, our truck, to take a shot at the guys. They were coming almost directly at us. We didn't get there. As they came in, they saw us, and they tilted their wings a couple times, and we saw that they were American. But had they been German, and we had all the thrills of the possibility of their being German, it was one of those moments. We'd have been goners if they'd seen us.
And there are plenty of occasions like that where that happened. We've heard some of those stories. You mentioned being in the cactus patch, so the thought came into my mind. You spent a lot of time clearing cactus for roads, and you spent a lot of time clearing mines. What would you rather be dealing with, mines or cactus?
By all means, cactus. Cactuses, of course, were new to most of us. We'd never seen them before.
They don't have them in South Dakota, huh?
I don't remember any. These were very big things, too. They were 15 foot high, some of them, I suppose. And they were dense, quite dense.
Another pivotal moment for Allied forces in North Africa came in late April of 1943 when your division took Hill 609. In fact, if you read Rick Atkinson's book, Army at Dawn, that's a great read. It was another veteran of the North African campaign, Leo Weil, that shared that one with me. Thanks, Leo. Anyway, Atkinson, if I remember correctly, calls the battle for Hill 609 the American Army's coming of age. What do you remember about Hill 609, and what made that hill so significant?
They just had a terrific view of a vast area. It was a outpost in that respect. Of course, it was protected. They had their pillboxes and foxholes and such, so that it was defended, but it was a vantage point for the Germans to track of us. We were headed for it one time with our mine detectors. There must have been five or six of us, and there it was, way up ahead, but high. And I don't think shots came from there, but they came from somewhere. And the bullets were zinging around us. Well, mine detector and all, we hit the ditch and hit it fast. That was one time. Scared? No, I don't think so. We just took action. We did our best. We had nothing really that we could get behind. We were fully exposed. We just got down low and pointed our helmets towards the oncoming rifle fire, hoping that it wouldn't get to us.
And I guess that's what I want to touch on as you talk about looking back and feeling like God protected you through a lot of things. Let's talk about some of those experiences. I just didn't want to gloss over anything in North Africa, because I know you ended up in Italy too. And again, you found yourself witnessing history that so many around the world have discussed in the 70 years since. In this case, the series of battles in the first 4 months of 1944 around the famous Monte Cassino Abbey in Italy. Allied forces were convinced that the Germans were inside the abbey. There's been a lot of debate over the years about this. Some have said the Germans agreed to stay out of the abbey as long as any of the monks remained there.
Supposedly they weren't up there. I don't know. I don't really believe that. I think they must have been there, because it, again, was a viewpoint where they could observe a vast valley, and we were across that valley at some altitude up a ways where our bivouac was for the artillery. And combat engineers in the artillery bivouac generally in the same area. They spent their daytime in the undercover, maybe, or maybe they shot, the artillery did. But we, from that vantage point, actually watched the bombers went over us to bomb the Abbey. We watched them bomb the Abbey.
And for a while there, you thought they might be bombing you?
A flight of B-17s that went over us. And as they came, at least one of them opened the door, opened the bomb bay doors, and it was where we could see, detect that the bomb bay doors were opening. And then little bombs started falling out, and they were coming right toward us. And that's quite a story, because we just moved into an area. We dug a garbage pit, 6 foot deep and 6 foot square. And when those bombs started coming down in our general area, that whole 6 foot square cube was full of humanity. I wasn't quick enough to get in there, so I had a mortar shell hole, which was maybe 12 inches deep at the most, 7 foot across, and I tried to get in that for protection. But the bombs fell short, so we didn't really hit. But it was an experience.
But how close did those bombs come to you? I mean, you guys are diving in the holes.
We heard them hit and blow up, but they were a mile away, maybe.
But there were moments where the threat of death came a whole lot closer than that. We'll touch on that when we return. And also remember one of the more than 400,000 Americans who did not come home from World War II. A man who Vern believes deserves to be recognized for his courageous sacrifice that may have saved the lives of others. By the way, if you ever find yourself in Pierre, South Dakota, that's the capital, of course, you can visit the South Dakota National Guard Museum and find many items that Vern donated for their display recognizing the 109th Engineers. Back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
Help us help a veteran. The Farney Automotive Group in Selma is supporting the Central Valley Honor Flight. A portion of the profit from every new and used vehicle sale in the month of August will be donated to help send our local veterans on an unforgettable trip to Washington, D.C. The Central Valley chapter is chartering flights in honor of their sacrifice and service to our country. Join the Farney Automotive Group in Selma and support our veterans for one more tour with honor.
The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selsler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Before we get to the rest of Vern Jackson's story, a quick heads up for you. Tuesday night, I'm going to be in Tulare for the Downtown Association Street Fair. They're helping us raise money for Central Valley Honor Flight and the mission of taking our World War II veterans to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. The first flight for Central Valley Honor Flight will be in October. And coming up on September 24th in Lemoore, we're going to host a screening of the award-winning Honor Flight documentary. You'll hear more details in the weeks ahead, but just mark that date on your calendar, will you? September 24th. Plan on being at the Golden Eagle Arena at West Hills Lemoore with some special guests like Congressman David Valadeo. Our guest today, Vern Jackson, is signed up to go to the memorial with Honor Flight Kern County. Hopefully that's going to happen very, very soon. That would be another chapter in a pretty adventurous life. Vern's post-war career included work on Titan rocket engines as well as other military-related high-tech products. But none of that would have ever happened if he didn't survive some other close calls during the war. Let's go back to Italy now, Vern. Near Cassino, you saw within 100 yards of you an American tank get knocked out by the enemy, and then some other things unfolded. Why don't you pick it up from there for us?
The tank knockout was kind of interesting because we were in a position where we could observe a wide open area, and the tank had been knocked out by a mine. The guys, we saw them come out of the tank, and run for cover. Then there was one gentleman who was having trouble. He'd been wounded in the incident, and he was hurt, and they left him. But a lieutenant, pulled his gun out and says, "Guys, get back there, get that guy." They went back and got him. But a little later, he was there in the building with us, and he was dead. He didn't survive it. This particular cave, this is a time that the infantry in the Battle for Casino had been brought down in strength to about half. They had a lot of casualties. And they got the idea that an engineer with a flamethrower could fill in for those 50 men that 50% that were missing. So they assigned us one individual with a mine detector to each platoon of 40 or 50 men, if there were that many left. I was lucky. I got in headquarters. I was in reserve, and we were in a cave, about big enough for 10 men to lie down. We were spent several days there. Outside of the cave was a area about rock stone-walled around, 20 foot square roughly, with openings from the cave to that area, and then openings from that area to the area where the tank had got knocked out. But somebody brought in two Germans. We held them for an interrogator. And in that time, I was standing in the door of the cave, which was more or less like a door. About 4 foot in front of me was the interrogator and the two Germans facing him. A mortar round, German mortar round, came into that 20-foot square, stone-walled, 12-foot high, say, roughly walls area. Had it done its job, it would have obviously killed us all. But it didn't. It bounced off one of the walls, the nose of it, where the detonator would be, and the tail fin broke off, but the mortar shell itself hit one guy on the chest and broke another guy's leg. The Germans, I missed something. When they first came in, we stood them against a wall to the left of the entry to the cave where we had deposited trash and excrement, and there stood the two Germans, scared to death. They were sure they were going to get shot, but we were just holding them for the interrogator. I don't know what happened after that mortar shell. I remember the two wounded guys, we had them in the cave, and we had a medic, and they were looking after them, but I don't know what happened to the Germans.
Obviously, never having experienced something like that myself, I'm trying to imagine what that felt like. Because when you see that mortar round come in...
We didn't see it come in. It was just suddenly there.
Is there a moment, though, where you realize, uh-oh, this is it? Or it happened so fast that you already knew you were safe?
No, there was one thing, they called it the Screaming Mimi. It was a rocket, I'm pretty sure, and they came in screaming. So you knew that was coming. Mortar shells or any projectile that's going to hit you, you're not going to hear it. If they're going by, you'll hear it. Anzio Annie was the worst example. We missed Anzio. That was one of the major experiences in Italy. But we were from the beachhead, from Anzio City, to the front. 8 miles, maybe something like that, I don't know. We were bivouacked out 2 or 3 miles from Anzio, and Anzio Annie was an enormous railroad gun. Yeah. I think it had 14-inch projectiles.
It's the one they would hide back in the tunnel, then roll it out to fire?
The daytime it would spend in the tunnel, but at night they'd roll it out and shoot it, Anzio or anything else that was a target. It went over, breaking the sound barrier with a awful noise, and then the noise of it hitting. Anzio Annie was a scary thing. I got to play around on the site of that gun later and take a picture of it.
Take me back to that cave and the mortar round coming in, because I know it all happened so fast, but when did it hit you that, you know, this is pretty incredible that you actually survived, because it's a recipe for complete demolition of that room, the way it unfolded.
It's automatic. You're still alive, and it didn't go off. It's laying there. You know what it did? It hit two guys.
But looking back now, you feel pretty fortunate to be alive, given how much worse that could have been.
Certainly. Death was pretty close there.
And I know another thing that struck me when reading some of the things you've written down about your experiences, and this show primarily focuses on what you guys who are still around did during the war, what you specifically experienced on a personal level. But I'm always struck, too, when I talk to veterans who see a real example of courage and bravery in one of their fellow soldiers. And I know you have at least one, if not more, of those. Tell me about the young man that maybe you didn't realize at the time how courageous he was.
We didn't get out of combat or out of danger just because we got in headquarters company. But Joe Paul and I were assigned to clear a rather large beach. I don't know what they wanted it for. Go swimming, maybe. It had been tank mines, heavily. very heavily. Joe and I were assigned to clear that beach. It was 100 yards long, at least, maybe 200. The lieutenant took us out, left us off with the equipment that we needed. We spent the whole morning blowing up mines, 10 at a time, with electric, with a block of TNT in each one, electrically connected, so that you'd blow 10 at once with your little detonator machine.
You make that sound real simple, but it sure seems to me like it would be pretty nerve-wracking not knowing where all these are and how they're all going to go up.
It was a sandy beach, and enough of them were exposed, so you got a pretty good feel for what things were. But that was routine. We had to do that. We hunted for mines. Mine detector, find them, and then dig them out.
So it was never a big deal to you.
Where the detonators were for the tank, they were right on top. But for booby traps, there was a place on the side where a detonator was screwed in with a tripwire or whatever. And we knew where we had to go on the mine. We'd feel the way around it, unscrew the detonator. Well, first you'd do something to neutralize the firing pin.
And how delicate is that? Is this the kind of thing where if you bump the wrong piece or you twist it the wrong way that you're going to be up in smoke?
Let me get to one instance. We'd worked all morning doing this and probably blew up 300 mines or more. We got a tenth of the mine field taken care of. And the lieutenant came out at noon and he realized, gosh, I gave these guys too big a job. We'll send out a line platoon to help them. So another half an hour later, 40 men come out. Well, Benny Kaiser and John Macnick were introduced to Joe and I, and we introduced them to the minefield where we had been lifting. And the minefield had changed from just anti-tanks. In between this minefield, and this is why the lieutenant realized we had too big a job for two guys, were anti-personnel mines, the kind that jump out of the ground 6 feet and blow up in all directions, sending little pellets that can do a lot of damage to a lot of people. We'd worked in this pattern of mines where the anti-personnel mines were in between. We'd worked into it 10, 15 feet out of a 30-foot. Anyhow, we'd worked into it. We'd opened it up. We introduced it to them, and they were capable guys, highly capable. And we went down to the other end of the minefield where there was a pier where bomb disposal people had put some bombs out on the end of it and blew them up. And the concussion had caused the anti-tank mines to detonate. And so there were sand piles there and slight depressions of, say, 3 foot deep, maybe. Well, I was down there digging through the sand for these three wires because we needed to know whether there were anti-personnel mines down in that part of the field, too. And I unscrewed the detonator and hold it up in the air and fire it, go off about like a rifle shell. Well, I had done that to two or three mines, anti-personnel mines, when there was a bang up where we'd been, where Benny and John had taken over. And I think we saw body pieces in the air. Maybe just visualize it. But we ran up there, and sure as heck, two men had been wounded. John was out of the field leaning against something with holes in him, dying. He was gasping. He was going. But Benny was blown to pieces. He was just erupted from stem to stern. He was intestines all over the place. Very, very dead. Well, the two wounded needed to be taken to field hospital, so we had a pickup truck, weapons carrier, we called him, and we hauled off the two guys. Then we came back, and his platoon had not touched the two bodies. So we got the pleasure of loading John into the pickup and putting Benny together in a couple of blankets, and putting him in, taking those two to grave registration. We didn't think about anything at the time. It's just you don't. But years later, 10 years ago, when I was going for hearing aids from the Veterans Administration, I was reviewing the concussions that I'd experienced, the explosions, and I could see Benny getting blown and, well, realize that he had 7 seconds, 5 to 7 seconds, from the time this mine popped to the time it would come out of the ground. And he could run, but it was a poor chance because the pellets would come from everywhere. He knew that his platoon would be in great jeopardy. He put his body, I believe, I realized in retrospect, that he had undoubtedly put his body on that mine to keep it in the ground where the pellets would not go far. And realizing that, I started an effort to have him recognized posthumously as a hero. I carried it to the politician in Rapid City and was getting some action. And she lost her office. The election came, she lost her office. And I never got to follow it up fully, and I've given up on it. I feel bad about it. I would like to do it yet, but I did get to his family. One, his brother lived in Merced. Other family members, they weren't brother or sister, they were cousins and such in the Rapid City area. And they were very happy to know, to meet someone who knew how their brother died, or their uncle or cousin or whatever. So I did something kind of worthwhile in contacting family members. And I tried to pick up the effort again, but...
Maybe we can help with that. You're not done yet. We're going to try. And whether or not a medal ever materializes or recognition, just what you did in sharing that story with his family, I'm sure was very, very meaningful for them. And I can tell that his story is still meaningful to you. And I often reflect with veterans on this show about that verse in the Bible, John 15:13. Where greater love has no man than this, than he laid down his life for his friend. And it sounds like there's no doubt in your mind that's what Ben did.
Yes, yes, it's true. Why it detonated is a question. Hang fire is a good explanation, it's the best explanation. The three little wires stick up. In soft ground, you depress those wires and it sets a little charge off that burns from the top of the mine, which is about 10 inches deep, 6 inches across. Maybe a little smaller than that. The powder train that burns from the detonator, wires having been pressed, a little cap in there that fires, burns down to the bottom of the mine, and then there's powder there which blows the mine into the air. And that could have been partly depressed, just hanging, waiting to be jolted. That's my best explanation. Because he was a highly capable fellow. I have record from his high school athletic days. He was loved and respected by his classmates in a major way. He was an extremely fine type young man. And I can visualize him having given his life for his troops very easily.
Not that it matters whether it was one or 20, but, I mean, do you have a gauge on potentially how many lives were saved by his sacrifice?
No, not at all. No, there were the two that were close and were killed, Benny and his friend. You work together generally in something like that. There were two fellows that were wounded, and they were wounded low in the body, I think. One of them was, I know. I visited them, too. They, incidentally, one of them said, I always thought he'd done that. Why we didn't take action or cause the officers to recognize what had happened and take action, I don't know. It baffles me yet, but it's the way things are in combat.
What would you like to see happen for him? How would you like him to be recognized?
I'd like to see him at least get a Silver Star posthumous. Had that thing gone off above ground, it would have wiped out any number. I don't know where the platoon personnel were standing at the time it went off. I don't know. They wouldn't be too close, but this thing is deadly and for quite a distance.
When you think about the fact that you're 92 now, that so much of this is so far in the past and so few today understand it and remember it, what are the things that you most want us to know, to remember about you and your generation?
I'm afraid I have a feeling that we were different than the present generation of 18 to 25, 30-year-olds. I don't know. It did take an event of some magnitude to mobilize us to be warriors, to be soldiers, to go into combat and fight for our country. I'm just afraid we wouldn't do it. I'm terrified by it. I may be wrong. I sure hope I am. The right circumstances could do it, but I get the impression that we're of a divided country and that war is something that they wouldn't have anything to do with.
What do you think it was that made you so united then?
Our upbringing gave us a love of country. We still thought we were a great nation. I think that's a kind of a half-held sentiment now. We have made mistakes, obviously, and not done exactly the right thing at all times. But for goodness sakes, the things that we have done as a country, we supported that war. We gave lives by the hundreds of thousands, and we've done it repeatedly, and we've gone in every incident that comes up, every catastrophe, we go in full force. Our nation is extremely honorable. I believe it is a nation endowed by God to be representative of the Christian faith. I think we had a different attitude towards our history of our country. I think we respected it, and I don't think people respect it now.
I just want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. Thank you for what you've done to honor your fellow soldier who gave his life. As we wrap up, what would you say you're most proud of or most thankful for all these years later?
Oh, my. I get emotional at this point. I would say the assurance that I have that God Almighty was aware of me, of all things. His presence, his magnitude, his majesty is just inconceivable to us. I think maybe I have a pretty fair vision, as good a visualization as of anyone, of the person of a creator that actually created everything. Gosh, well, Friday, butterflies didn't happen. There is intelligence in that design. And I fully believe it, and I am thankful that I have been given the conviction and the awareness that God has watched me and that he has a future for me. At my point in life, I don't fear death. I've developed heart murmurs, I've told you, and I'm pretty puny because I don't get enough oxygen in my blood, and I'm willing to face death. I will accept a simple repair, but I'm not going to have my life stop essentially for 3-4 months while I heal invasion into my chest. I'd rather meet my maker.
Well, I think all our listeners will join me in saying we hope that's a ways off, and I hope we can get your friend Ben Kaiser honored for his supreme sacrifice before then. That's Vern Jackson, 92 years old. See what he looks like by pulling up his photos on Facebook. Just punch in Hometown Heroes Radio. And join us again next time for another edition of Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.